It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with your friends if you find it of interest. Today, we have a conversation with Jeanette Cooper, who is a lifelong educator from the Chicago area. She found herself in a unique and terrible situation that seems to be all too common or increasingly common in America today, one that really came out of nowhere and resulted in the taking away of her child due to a dispute over claims that she is transgender. This is a terrible story. It's something that really is very emotional and very touching and hard, very personal. And Jeanette is speaking out about it because of the importance of this type of story, understanding what really goes on. Every situation like this is unique and the individuals are unique. But this is a challenge that unfortunately many parents find themselves in or find of concern these days. It was profiled by Kelsey Bolar, who is over at the Independent Women's Forum, and you can find a documentary video that she made about this at iwf.org. It's something that I encourage you all to watch and to learn from and to read Kelsey's story about Jeanette. Jeanette Cooper, coming up next.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on foxnewspodcast.com.
Jeanette Cooper, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and your situation.
Oh, yeah. So I'm a lifelong educator. I'm currently a PhD candidate at DePaul University in Education. I've spent my life probably since I was about 10 working with children in various capacities, whether that's tutoring them or kind of in the broader educational realm in the community. So I have an only child, Sophia, my daughter. She's going to be 16 this month. A little bit of background about what has happened to me. So when my daughter was 12, just before her 13th birthday, she went to her dad's house for a regular custodial visit. I had had her 7 days a week, 6 nights a week since our divorce about 4 years previous. And she went on a regular visit for 3.5 hours. I went to go pick her up and he refused to release her back into my custody. I never saw her. She was inside his house. And I honestly was quite confused. I had really no idea what was going on. And I got in my car. I thought it was super odd for this to be happening, him kind of refusing to release her back into my custody. That had never really happened. So I sent my attorney an email that said that I thought that something was weird and that maybe I would contact her tomorrow. I told her what was happening. And then I went back home. The next day I received kind of an email, a scripted, I think many parents receive these. Children are learning how to write a letter that declares a trans identity. My daughter wrote one that sounds very much like the other ones that parents receive. And I looked at that and honestly, I was quite confused. It didn't make sense for her. So I kind of looked at it and thought, that's interesting. I'm not sure I much had any other emotions around that, more confusion. So I wrote back to my attorney. I you know, communicated to my ex-husband, Sophia needs to come home. This doesn't make sense. I'm not sure what's going on. And then I was quickly in court on an emergency petition for return of custody. We also went to mediation, which is how we got to the agreement that I had her 7 days a week, 6 nights a week. It wasn't a custody battle for sure. It was a simple agreement based upon our schedules and our ability to parent and spend time with our daughter. So I went to family court. Family court kept my daughter in my ex-husband's custody as a precautionary measure because my daughter had used the word unsafe. Now, I felt perfectly comfortable with that because when children say they're unsafe, you should really investigate. I was okay with that. It made sense because they really didn't have enough information to say one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But I never received even an ability to have lunch with her that day. I hadn't seen her then in about 10 days, the longest that I had ever been away from her in my entire life. That was awful. I would say the next six to 9 months of my life, felt a bit like a concussion. I had no idea, what exactly, I was being kind of judged for, but then when the court investigation kind of came out, it wasn't a Child Protective Services investigation because there was no allegation of abuse or neglect. What really happened was a custody evaluation in Illinois. It's called a 604B evaluation, and they do psychological testing, hours and hours of interviews with both parents, and then they come out with some sort of recommendation for custody. The only finding really in that kind of report related to the child was that I did not have an understanding of her transgender identity. I would interpret that more that I didn't have a belief that such a child exists as is transgender, something different than other children. So I think they expected me to have this belief that my daughter was this special type of child called a transgender child. And I simply don't believe that. So I complied with all of their recommendations. I went to, I went to family therapy, which is the only time I've seen my daughter in the past now over 3 years. I've seen her for less than 10 hours in the past 3 years. And it seems that I'm not in compliance with their belief system about affirming this identity and that this this affirmation process of kind of using a name that is, that is it's a fictional character's name. Many children choose names such as this, and then pronouns that have no relationship to her body and no relationship to the way that we use pronouns in society. So I don't think that's psychologically healthy for children. I know children very well. I know child development. And so I don't think that's psychologically healthy for a child. And I don't wish to participate in that because I don't think it's good parenting.
The thing that I hear a lot or that I've heard a lot from people who are critics of people in your situation or, have lots of opinions online.
Sure.
Is that basically people in your position are choosing not to affirm over having a relationship with your child. Obviously this has to be deeply important to you and to not go along with that and just cave the way that I think a lot of parents, many of them astounded by the situation end up doing. What went into your thought process along those lines and how do you perceive it in ways that I assume are different than the ways that people who have opinions about this would express it?
Right. I think that, number one, many people can have many opinions about other people's lives. I have no idea what goes on in anybody else's context to the sense that they do. So I honestly believe that people are making the best choices given their situations, their support network and all of that. So that I would say, number one, I think everybody is doing the best that they can. Number two, I'm not sure this is quite clear, but I did affirm my daughter. Within 10 days, I sent a letter, an email to her, kind of stating my affirmation. I was excited. I stated that I was excited to kind of learn more about this new identity, the name. I used this chosen name that she had decided upon that she wanted to be called in this moment of her life. I use that in family therapy. I use the pronouns. All of my communication to third parties use those pronouns that she wished at that time. There was no point at which I didn't follow that during the court process. So So I'm not sure that critique is well-founded. Simply, people don't know that. The idea that I'm somehow choosing a belief over a relationship with my child, that's a false dichotomy. You can do both, and that is parenting, right? We parent out of a value system. We parent out of a belief system, and that's the way that we live our lives. So those things are not mutually exclusive. I am doing both. And that really is related to the concept of support versus enabling. I'm supporting healthy behavior. I'm supporting my daughter, but I'm not enabling unhealthy behavior by doing something that I don't think is good parenting. So what I say in the documentary that Independent Women's Forum released was that this is parenting. I mean, this is holding a boundary. It's being clear about my deep love for her. And that I don't think that participating in kind of this, what I consider kind of psychological, going down a psychological path that I don't think is healthy for children, and I think kind of stunts their growth, their social emotional growth. I don't want to participate in that because I don't think it's good parenting. But what I'm doing now is good parenting. It is holding a boundary. My daughter knows very deeply that I love her, or else I don't think she would do this. Children only push to the point that they hit a boundary, and she knows that my boundary is quite wide. I mean, I'm quite a progressive person. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's you have to push very, very far to hit a boundary with me, because I'm very open to many different ideas and thoughts.
Before you had this happen to your daughter, before you learned of this of your daughter, how did you feel about other parents who went through experiences like this that you might have read or heard about?
Oh, that's interesting. So I really hadn't, I mean, I have been in kind of the radical feminist community for quite a number of years. Radical, not meaning, you know, guns and killing people, radical meaning to the root of something, yeah. Right? The word radical is kind of misused, but radical meaning to the root of something. So I had been in that community for quite a while. I think my daughter grew up kind of knowing the extent that that females could exist in the world in many different ways. I think she visually saw that at many of the different things that we attended together. The wide range of a female that can exist in the world. So she could kind of envision herself somewhere along all of that, I'm sure. And she doesn't have really any body hatred, anything like that at all. She's actually never wanted any of those things. So previous to this, I could see that there were some individuals in the world who were using, adopting a transgender identity to kind of cope with a lot of the pressures that society puts on people about how they should act, what they should do, and how they should be and exist. And so I could see people kind of without a lot of support around them kind of, well, you use the word caving, but I'm not sure I would say that. I would say coping with what is happening in the world. So I know I've taken lots of workshops after this has happened to me through a professional development organization called PESI that's really for mental health professionals. And so I've learned a lot about self-harm and suicide and things like that, and the way that people cope in ways that, you know, keeps negative attention away from them, but keeps all attention away from them. So people who, for example, will choose to, let's say, shave off their hair and wear very baggy clothing or something like that to make them unattractive to anyone. That could be because of some sort of sexual assault, and they want people to be away from their own bodies and stay away from them. But what it also does is it cuts them off from very healthy relationships, because it makes them actually visually appear very unappealing to somebody, very standoffish, I suppose. So those kind of unhealthy coping mechanisms I could see cropping up in, you know, I live in downtown Chicago, so I could see that in the society in general through adults. And I really felt that what people needed who were kind of trying to cope in the world in a way that identified them out of their sex, to say, I'm not that person. I'm not going to kind of adhere to this idea that females should be feminine. I instead am going to say that I'm a man. I told my daughter, and I feel very strongly that what those people need is to feel a sense of community within their sex. So I kind of approach it more with compassion, because I understand it's a form of coping to try to identify out of your sex. Now, what I see, though, is children who are doing this to kind of adopt a new sense, a new self. So and that's kind of cool and fun when you're 12, maybe. But as you get closer to something like my daughter's in high school and she's using a name that does not match her birth certificate. And how, you know, maybe you, Ben, when you were younger, you adopted a transformer kind of persona and every day in school, you dressed as, you know, some sort of like Spider-Man or I don't know what.
I can tell you exactly what I did, which is that I wore an Indiana Jones hat for like 3 years.
Oh my gosh. See, that's fantastic. You have a prime example. So then there was probably like a day where you're like, meh.
Yeah. Don't feel like wearing the hat anymore.
Yeah. And you just stopped wearing it, right? You just took it. You just took it off. You left it there and nobody really noticed, or somebody might have said, hey, where's your hat? Yeah. But that's it. After a couple of days, kind of over.
Yeah.
And that's a normal adolescent thing. Unfortunately, in this particular case, if any of our children wish to kind of drop this, you know, identity that they were playing with or whatever, mm-hmm. this name that they picked when they were 11, it's a little harder.
Yeah.
And they're a little bit painted into a corner here.
That's something I wanted to ask you about, because it seems to me like in so many of these situations, especially with the, you know, the younger the child is, it sets them up for a situation where in order to back off of that in a kind of a natural way, that lots of phases happen to people during their lives, whether they're, yes. they're coping with something or they're, mm-hmm. they're, you know, entertaining something, it becomes something much more fundamental and embarrassing, mm-hmm. as opposed to just, you know, leaving the hat at home or saying, you know, I wanted to be called by this nickname, but I don't want to be called that anymore. Right. That is something that I think is an avenue that's closed off to kids, mm-hmm. when we sort of push them or adults push them into this direction. How do you feel about that? And do you feel like this is something where it would be just too embarrassing, basically, for either your daughter or for children, mm-hmm. or young teens who've gotten into this, to basically reverse something that seemed so, or was presented as so fundamental to their identity?
It's a very good question. So what we see in people who choose to detransition, which is kind of a false idea that you can go back in time, you cannot. There's time that you've lost in your life, and there's things that have changed about your own body and self that I'm not sure that detransition is the right word, but people who are kind of formerly trans, they explain that when they realize, oh my gosh, I don't want to be doing this anymore, it takes them approximately a year to say something, because there's a heavy amount of shame from kind of pushing the people around them to comply with all kinds of demands that they thought were really good for them at the time. So it's a little bit hard for them to get out of that. A lot of our children and these young people and even adults have a lot of anxiety and depression, and that really makes it a whole lot harder. That anxiety makes it a whole lot harder to say, hey, guess what? I kind of don't want to use this name anymore. Can you just call me this? You know, I just kind of want to go back to that other name that I had earlier in my life. You know, and the way to get over anxiety around all of that, I think it's just to do it, because the idea that somehow some child is going to say to their mom, hey, you know, I just want to be called Doug again. Like, I don't want to be called this other name. You know what their mom is probably going to say, and what I would say to any child, I'd say, okay. And that would be it. Because I think we know that children they try things, and that's normal. And I think it has more to do with a person if they wish to shame a child for something like this, right? An adult says, well, why did you make me do this? And you were such a bully and all of these things. Mm-hmm. That has a lot to do with an adult. But to be honest, most of the adults that are around children who are supporting these identities, most of them will say, okay, that's fine. That sounds good. Mm-hmm. If that's what you want, you know, that's good. That's what I would do. And that's what I would hope that other adults would do, is they would say, all right, that's great. I can do that. And the shame and the embarrassment and all of those things kind of fall away. I think anxiety in children and adults too, makes us think that things are going to be so much worse, that black and white thinking, things are going to be awful, awful, awful. And generally they aren't, they really aren't. Most of the time people are kind of involved in their own lives. They're not actually contemplating kind of reliving the worst moments of your life in front of your face. They have other things going on in their lives.
Tell me a little bit about other parents who you've connected with through this process and through sharing your story and everything like that. You know, parents who presumably, you know, have had to adapt to or confront a lot of the same things that you have, or similar mm-hmm. things and things that are different as well. What have you learned from them or heard from them in response?
Yeah, there's a few things. I think that I run a parent group on Facebook called Concerned Parents of Transgender Non-Binary Kids, Teens, and Young Adults, that I started with a friend of mine, Donna, and we gathered kind of a group of moderators who had a bunch of different life experiences, a bunch of different experiences with their children around transgender identity. And we managed to build a really great group that is really, it's about questions, not so much about support. We don't support everything, but we do hold two pillars of curiosity and compassion around this issue in parenting. What we see is people who have children, maybe let's say 12 and under, their children mostly desist out of this transgender identity because they're using it to cope with something. And so there's a lot of ways in which the parent can change the environment for the child so that they have kind of fewer stressors that they are trying to cope with by using this transgender identity. Children who are a bit older, it's a little bit more complicated to change the environment of the child. So what we say is you cannot control your child, and you shouldn't want to actually control another human being. But you can change the environment around the child, and that includes you. So if your child has severe anxiety, and maybe your cat has severe anxiety, then maybe look in the mirror, you know, figure out what kind of ways that you're coping in the world, and maybe work on some of the things yourself that you've struggled with as a human being and as a parent. And you can kind of change yourself, of course, work on things yourself, but also change the environment around your child. Some people will say, some people recommend, for example, like, let's get the kid off the internet. And whatever a child is doing, they're doing it. All behavior is goal-oriented. So they're using something in relationship to a goal. So figure out what they're getting from, let's say, connecting with people on social media, strangers on social media, or kind of watching videos incessantly or something like that. What are they getting out of that? They're getting something. And so find a different activity that is probably healthier, involves more, you know, human connection, which is more complex inputs for the brain. The brain works harder and grows more when we have human to human interactions, face to face. So rather than kind of this yank away the internet and social media, it's more of a substitution is what we see as successful with kind of orienting children toward the human experience. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the lessons I think that we have learned in the parent group. We started the group in February of a year and a half ago. So in almost a year and a half, we have, you know, we're getting close to 3,000 members. So, and it's parents who make all kinds of choices in their lives. Some parents choose to use, whatever name their child wants at this particular moment in their life. And maybe they use pronouns, maybe they change it at the school. Maybe they go against, you know, they go to the school and say, no, I don't want you to use that name and pronouns. And they do whatever is best for their family, to be honest. I mean, that's the thing about parenting and the parenting authority is we have the authority to kind of take our value system, take our belief system and instill that in our children. That's a fundamental constitutional right. So that's something that we as a group, you know, of concerned parents in this Facebook group, we say you have the authority. That's your duty and that's your responsibility. But that comes with authority to make decisions that are best for your family. Outside of the state guidelines, every state has guidelines for abuse and neglect. Everything else is really under the authority of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of America, to be honest. I mean, that's kind of the wonderful thing that we all live in different ways. I mean, that's kind of amazing.
Yes. E pluribus unum.
Yes.
I have a young daughter, mm-hmm. and I hear high levels of concern from my many friends, particularly the mothers of young daughters, about the pressure that they expect to be put up on them from the world and from social media and from other, either cultural forces or just the aspect of this that comes from outside the home, not from the parent, but from things that they feel they can't control and that will send their daughter into questioning things that they believe, would lead them to make decisions that could be rash and that they could find regrettable to go down these paths. And many of them say some form of this story to me. You know, when I was young, I was a tomboy, or I was, an outdoorsy girl, or I was one who, was an athlete, played with all the boys, but I love being a woman and I'm glad that I'm a woman. I'm glad that no one, gave me hormones or, sent me in some path that I would regret. And I even hear that from my friends who are lesbians, who are, very happy being a lesbian as opposed to being someone who was put into that path towards transition. Mm-hmm. What advice, given the experience that you've had, would you give to the parents of young daughters who have this type of concern about the world that we are inhabiting and the trends that they see?
Okay, so the human experience in terms of adolescence and this period of time, and even through young adulthood, and maybe even the entire premise of psychotherapy, would be, what can we control in our environment? And that is the serenity prayer, right? Figuring out what you can control and what you cannot. So that's kind of a first idea. And that's a lot of what happens in adolescence. You're pushing against kinds of things to figure out where those boundaries are, but also what can you control? In this particular environment, what we're watching is adolescents figuring out that they can say jump. And there are certain adults in their environment, currently quite a few educators and many psychotherapists, who will then respond with, how high? Mm. And then there are other adults, I consider myself in this group, I don't respond in that way. So I think we can kind of see groups of adults who I would describe as enabling, who are more interested in operating out of a sense of fear. And that's really no way to parent, and certainly no way to be a professional. They're fearful of a child not liking them, or they're fearful of being around a person who is in distress and upset. I think, it takes an adult who has some resilience to be able to be around a person in distress and to just sit and be present and not kind of absorb all of that distress within them, to kind of hold space for that person and just be present. So in those distressing moments, we used to we'd have an argument with somebody, or we'd have some moment, and then we would just have to sit with our feelings. And over time, the body actually regulates all of those chemicals. And then those feelings kind of dissipate little by little, because the chemicals work themselves out in the brain and all of that. And maybe we take a walk, and maybe we sit. I used to sit and draw and paint and do like lots of artwork. And then those feelings kind of dissipate in the body and the brain. And then we see that there's a rise, and then it kind of goes away little by little. And that's a normal human evolutionary process. Right now, we're kind of we're interfering with that, with the idea that we have an electronic device in our hand, or we have access to a telephone pretty much all the time. That those feelings then are not given the opportunity to dissipate as they have throughout, lifetimes and lifetimes and generations. Mm-hmm. And so our bodies are not reacting in that way. We're having a kind of a lot of things going on in our brain chemically and socially, of course, to then ruminate on things, and the dissipation of that doesn't happen. So that's something that I think parents can do, which is they can allow their child to have small distressing moments, of course, to experience those. We're not talking about trauma. We're talking about small distressing moments. And that's how you build resilience. I mean, 10 years ago, if you look at the news, that's what we were talking about. We were talking about building resilience in children. And that's something that still needs to happen. But I'll be honest, it needs to happen with adults too. They're the ones who cannot cope with being around a 12-year-old who's upset. They're the ones who are kind of, you say caving, but they're the ones who don't have enough resilience in them as adults to be able to say, I'm sorry, honey, I'm not going to do that, you know, and I know you're upset with me. But if your teenager really thinks you're the best parent in the world, and they say it all the time, you're probably not setting good boundaries. I mean, let's be honest.
Oh, absolutely.
There's probably something a little bit off about what you know about risk taking in adolescence and the reasoning ability that comes. It has a bit of a 3 to 5 year lag after that. So we have to recall that every person in the world, particularly young people, are trying to figure out what impact they can have on the world and how, and what we are watching as adults is how are they impacted by the world. So it's always that we're always in tension around that as human beings. So as we come into the world, we impact the world, of course, because every human being is incredibly valuable to our society as a whole, but humanity as a greater thing. So every human being impacts the world, but they are also impacted by it. That is absolutely the struggle of, let's say, you know, liberalism and conservatism. Yeah. How is that tension kind of balanced out? And children are trying to figure that out, particularly in these teenage years. How can I impact the world? And then the world kind of holds some boundaries, or I don't want to say pushes back, but holds some boundaries around that and says, you can't impact it that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can, but there are some things that have been here for generations and generations. And yes, you will impact those things. And that's how culture moves around. And we want children and young people to impact the world. Absolutely. But there is a bit of a precariousness, particularly in this country. We hold a delicate balance. And so right now, what we're seeing is a little bit of a tipping, a little bit of a discomfort, of course, in this particular cultural moment and that we're living through. I'm a parent who has, like I said, very wide boundaries, and they really relate to safety. I mean, you had asked me about what happened in my particular case. So I think Matt Walsh said something on his podcast. I wasn't on there, and I'd love to talk to him about this, but he said, I made a deal with the devil. When I signed my new parenting agreement maybe 6 months ago, I chose to get a provision that stopped any medicalization of this concept of gender, any puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, double mastectomy, anything like that. I wanted that provision, and that was the thing that I would put everything on the line for, because while my daughter doesn't want that right now, it would not shock you to think that teenagers change their mind on a whim. Mm-hmm. So I really, really wanted that above everything. And that's the thing that I was willing to not fight for any sort of face-to-face visitation or anything like that. Because I said, this is the thing that I want above everything else. This is what I want. I want to be able to prevent my daughter from making any, like you said, rash decisions that impact safety. What we're talking about is long-term health and safety, of the rest of her life. And the reason that is so important to me is not around the concept of fertility. That's not what I'm interested in. What I'm most concerned about in this particular moment with children is that puberty blockers plus cross-sex hormones inhibit the ability of a child then to develop the ability to have an orgasm ever in their life. Mm. It will totally prevent that. That's a human experience that I think is so necessary for people to relate in the world. And I think it's child abuse to take it away from a child. So for me, that provision around medicalization was the most important thing. And I would put everything on the line for that. So that's the decision making that I made. And that's particularly around what I consider safety.
Mm-hmm. I want to wrap up with this. You know, obviously you mentioned the IWF video, which we'll link, which I think that it's very well done, and I hope everyone watches it. I wonder, as you were participating in that, if you were thinking about your daughter and whether she would see that. What would you want her to take away if she did?
I think about my daughter pretty much every second of every day. I think my daughter knows me very well. Even when we kind of sat in family therapy together, she and I, she would face away from me, because I think she knows that just my presence of looking at her kind of surrounds her with a truth that is unavoidable. Just my existence and my holding of space. So I do think about everything that I say about my own story, because it is, you know, it's mine as much as it is hers, because it's a relationship between two people. And I always try to put at the forefront of my mind that she's a child. She's a child who tried something. I think she may feel in her mind like that I could have all kinds of emotions around that: anger, frustration, annoyance, all of those things. But what I most feel is kind of a sense of compassion for her situation and all of these children's situation, and all of the parents who I know who have affirmed their children, and then they say, "I shouldn't have done this." And they come to our group and they say, how do I go backwards in time? Or how do I move forward from here? And I think holding compassion for every human being, that they were making the best decision at the time, and that from this moment forward, they can always make a new decision. Every moment is such an opportunity for that. So I have such compassion for my daughter and really everybody in here. But I'll be honest, what I most miss is just seeing her. I don't know if she's taller than I am. And I think just about every parent knows whether their kid is taller than they are. I don't know some pretty fundamental things about her life that are pretty challenging to deal with. But I miss her terribly. It's really, really hard. So life is kind of made up of distracting yourself from trauma. Yeah. It's made up of trying to create good things in your life, to keep you focused on those good things and, you know, just wait it out, because something will change. I will change. She will change. The world will change. Things will change. They will not be in this moment all the time.
Mm-hmm. Jeanette, thank you so much for taking your time to share your story with me today.
I very much appreciate it, Ben.
The vote in the U.S. Senate to allow and support the addition of Sweden and Finland to the NATO alliance took place just the other day. It resulted in a 95-1 outcome. That one senator in opposition was Josh Hawley. If you're wondering about the others, Rand Paul voted present, and then there were three senators who did not vote but would have supported the addition. This was a situation where Hawley's critique was not even actually ideological. It was more about practical concerns that NATO is a distraction from our focus on China and Asia generally, which he believes ought to take more prominence within our foreign policy conversation. Personally, I don't understand that argument. It seems to me that Sweden and Finland are exactly the kind of nations that we should want in NATO. They pay either 2% of their GDP toward their military or more. And they have very, you know, serious and sophisticated militaries that are, you know, historically quite strong and mindful of Russian aggression. This is something that has been coming for a while, but it's certainly much more defensible than arguments about, say, Montenegro or the like, a point that Senator Tom Cotton made, especially considering that Senator Hawley had voted for the addition of Montenegro just a few years ago. to me, this 95-1 vote is an indication that perhaps the foreign policy on the right has not changed as much as people had claimed that it did under President Donald Trump. In fact, it seems to me to be an indication that, as I've argued, that it's a return to a form of foreign policy that existed prior to the invasion of Iraq and the effort to spawn a democratic peace in the Middle East. Those visions are fundamentally utopian, and to me, they seem to be completely at odds with the general inclination of the American people. I think they have to be viewed in retrospect in a certain clear light, though, given that the war in Iraq was not originally undertaken in order to turn it into a democracy. That came later. Instead, it was obviously advocated for on the basis of consideration of weapons of mass destruction. You all remember the case that Colin Powell made in front of the United Nations. This is something that I think, you know, is important to understand. The Iraq War was very popular. It was supported by everyone on both sides of the aisle, virtually, and certainly, you know, in retrospect, there's a lot of people who regret that support. One of those people who supported it at the time was, of course, Donald Trump as a civilian. He came to be one of its leading critics, of course, along with many others in the coalition of the right and the left. He viewed this as a war that was a massive mistake, something that I certainly agree with. It's a mistake that led to the deaths of almost 250,000 Iraqi civilians. It led to the dronings of innocents. It led to all manner of upheaval, desperation, and terror in terms of the response that came from ISIS, something that never probably would have happened had Saddam Hussein's regime held power. Now, of course, that regime was terrible. It engaged in terrible things. But what we've learned since is that we really had to focus more on Afghanistan and Pakistan as being the sources of the terrorist threats that were coming. And of course, there are remaining concerns that we never really found the degree to which the Saudi Arabian government knew what was going on in terms of their citizens. But regardless of your impression of the Iraq War, whether you supported it at the time, whether you oppose it now, as so many do, what I think we should understand in terms of the lessons moving forward is that America has to be very clear-eyed as to its goals when it gets involved in conflicts overseas. It has to know how to use its military. It has to have a military that is prepared. And that argument about preparedness is, I think, at the center right now of the conversation the right needs to be having. Is the military truly prepared for the kind of conflict that could happen in the case of Taiwan? Are our allies prepared to do what they need to do in order to carry the weight? Obviously, that they are much closer to that region, much more mindful of it, obviously, than we are. But even on just the semiconductor issue and the other issues related to a Taiwan that could be dominated by mainland China, it is such a pressing concern for us that we need to make sure that we have the military and particularly the Navy in question in order to deter that kind of action on the part of China. We saw the visit that Nancy Pelosi took there and the kind of reaction that it spawned in terms of live fire drills and the like from the Chinese. And that to me is a form of saber rattling that's only natural. It's something that they have to do in response to something like that. But that visit is, of course, more about optics than it is about something meaningful. The meaningful steps that we need to be taking now are the kinds that you heard in my interview with Elbridge Colby, the kinds that would ultimately make Taiwan a much pricklier porcupine when it comes to China trying to devour it. Personally, I think that's something that is going to happen in the coming years. I hope that it continues to happen, and I hope that those who want to have a shift on the right in terms of our foreign policy priorities understand that this form of deterrence is something that they ought to support as well as being in the interest of an America first foreign policy, one that hopes to never have an American have to die in order to defend anything related to our interests in the region of Taiwan. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
from the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.